Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another Fireside Chat. I am your host, Lance White. Tonight, I'm delighted to welcome Timothy Conway, Ph.D. Timothy is a freelance writer and educator living with his wife and two cats in my hometown, Santa Barbara, California. He is the author of an acclaimed work, Women of Power and Grace, 9 Astonishing, Inspiring Luminaries of Our Time. He is now publishing a 2-volume book on India's sages. So let's welcome Timothy to the show and now and find out more about Women of Power and Grace.
Well, first, hello, Lance, Timothy. Thank you for the opportunity to be on your show.
Oh, you know, I wouldn't miss this for the world. You know, I can't tell you how inspiring your book is. It's first of all, so that people tell the audience who's featured in the book and why you wrote it.
Oh, it might get a little laborious to name everyone. I guess I could real quick mention it opens with Saint Francesca Cabrini, an Italian immigrant woman who came to the United States and became a United States citizen. She was like the Mother Teresa of Calcutta of the early 20th century in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there's been many men and women around the world in different religious traditions and even in the secular humanist tradition who's done great works on behalf of the needy and the downtrodden. Francesca is an amazing case because, like the later Mother Teresa of Calcutta,
uh-huh,
who came to fame in the 1960s onward, she suffered terribly with bodily ailments. So the fact that by the age of 67, when she passed on, that she had founded like 67 charitable institutions in Italy, the United States, and elsewhere was pretty impressive. Well, then I covered a few other women from the Western Christian tradition.
Uh-huh.
When I say Western Christian, that actually also includes 2 women of the Eastern Orthodox Christian tradition.
Uh-huh.
A tremendous woman named Maria Skoltsova, whom a lot of scholars are interested in. She was a Russian woman, a Bolshevik, who became the mayor of a Russian town before she became disgusted with the communists and came down with many of the Russian exiles into Paris.
Uh-huh.
And she wound up being a leading figure in the resistance movement and helped smuggle a lot of Jews out of the Nazi-occupied areas to freedom. And then she herself was taken to one of the Nazi camps. And the day before that camp was liberated by the Russians, she took the place of one of the women who was destined to be killed that day.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, Maria went to her death. And, of course, the camps were liberated the next day. A very powerful teacher and a very earthy, kind of saucy woman. She was also a married woman, too, and then divorced and had children. So,
wow.
Francesca was a nun.
Uh-huh.
Maria Skoltsova was a laywoman. And then there was a couple of the, shall we call them, more of the kind of God's holy fool types.
Oh, yeah.
A German laywoman named Therese Neumann, who's famous for the stigmata wounds and many paranormal interdimensional things happening around her. And then a Russian woman whom very few people know about, except maybe Russian immigrants here in the West who,
uh-huh,
revere the great saint of maybe the last 1,000 years in the Eastern Orthodox tradition, Saint Seraphim of Sarov. His icon is in most Russian Orthodox churches. Well, he had a successor, and it was a woman, this incredible kind of holy fool archetype, a woman named Pelagia.
Oh, she was a strange one.
Oh, yeah. Well, this stuff is fascinating.
It really is.
Archetype worldwide.
Yeah. You know, it's just, these women are all so different.
Yeah.
And yet you get the sense that they are just totally divinely inspired, and that their lives are magically connected to God, and they all had paranormal abilities, didn't they?
Yes, especially when we get to the woman of the East.
Oh, yes.
5 of the 9 women happened to wind up living in India. One of them was an Afghani princess, Hazrat Babajan, who fled and arranged marriage apparently the day of her wedding in the southeast part of Afghanistan. And she, very courageous and dangerously, she fled up the Khyber Pass,
uh-huh,
apparently descended down into the mountains and hills in northwest India, trained with Sufi Muslim mystic teachers and also Hindu mystics,
and
wound up in a town called Pune, right outside of Bombay, several-hour drive by today's standards. And she just sat under a neem tree. It's a sacred tree in India there. And at this one neem tree in Pune, she sat there for the rest of her life, pretty much. She's incredible because people who will know of the famous Indian godman, Meher Baba, who dropped the body in 1969. When he was a young lad, just in his early teens, he was bicycling home from school one day. He knew of Hazrat Babajan. He had gone to see her a number of times, as had most of the community. They would go visit this great God-realized woman. She was just like a living monument to the divine, sitting motionlessly under that neem tree.
Wow.
But Meher Baba went over there that time when he was a young boy, and she beckoned to him. He came up. She kissed him on the forehead, and he went home, says he laid down, and basically for the next 9 months, said he ate nothing, drank nothing, thought of nothing, because he was just fully God-realized.
Wow.
His family members would see him pounding his head against the stone floor, stone walls, trying to have an experience of a body.
Wow.
See, we're trying to have an out-of-the-body experience and have spiritual, you know, journeys, but someone like that is just so completely God-realized for them to have an experience of the body.
You know, that just
made some desired thing.
That just made something kind of
ministry.
That made something fall into place for me right now when you said that. I couldn't understand why so many of these women are, you know, involved with violence to their own body. A lot of them were beaten or injured, or they had maggots eating fingers off.
Well, that was the case of Hazrat Babajan, some thief that tried to take, I guess, you know, one of the wedding bangles or rings that had been put on her finger when she was that young princess of Afghanistan. And she was completely happy to surrender it to him, but it apparently opened up a little wound in her finger, which became infected, and the local people who would see her daily wanted doctors to treat it. But she said basically, as the wound got more infected and finally maggots were there, she called the maggots, "Bacha, my little children." And finally the finger fell off. You know, as I wrote in that book, when you encounter these kind of episodes in the annals of spiritual literature about our humanity's greatest, most deeply and profoundly God-realized beings, you get a really strong sense that they know. And I wrote an essay many years ago. It won some essay award. It's up at my website. Called "This Is All a Dream." These sages know literally that this physical waking state is a dream, being divinely dreamed by God. And at a certain point, they get, shall we say, to a point of lucidly dreaming this daydream, the way we might have a lucid dream at night. And of course, a lucid dream, for the audience who might know, that's when you're dreaming and then suddenly you come awake in the dream and realize that it's a dream while it still unfolds.
Yes.
So these great holy women and the great holy men of history, the Buddha and Jesus and many others, they are really the creme de la creme of humanity's spiritual realized potential. And so for them, this whole play just becomes an ecstasy of divine bliss and love and delight.
Yeah.
And my sense is that their own divine self manifests all sorts of what for us would be extreme and bizarre and painful or traumatic situations. And for them, it's just like a lucid dream at night. It's just a big play.
Yeah.
And so that Hindu word, lila, becomes very potent. Meher Baba used to call it God's whim. And you have references in the Western mystical Christian tradition as well to this idea.
Just out of curiosity,
the last four women in that book were all great Hindu maas, Anandamayi Ma, Anasuya Devi, Shama Mataji. They've all passed on. But the one I wrote about in the last chapter, Amritanandamayi, the hugging mother,
she's
alive, and she visits the West, United States, and Europe and Japan and places every year. She's been visiting every year since 1987. And I always tell people, if you want to go see someone of that caliber, an apparent divine incarnation of just pure love and clarity and that lucid awakeness, go see Amma. Just her sitting for day and night after day and night over these last 30 years, hugging people one by one, in India, sometimes you'll sit straight for like 28 hours without moving, defying all our models of bodily needs and so forth. I've often told people just her stamina is some kind of a divine miracle.
Oh, yeah.
Not to mention all the healings of people's hearts and karma and relationships. It's pretty spectacular to see.
Well, people wake up, they awaken, don't they, in her presence?
Very much so.
You've been hugged by her. You tell the story about meeting her.
Yes, I was very lucky to be one of just a few people who saw a little book that the Indians and the Westerners who had discovered Amma through great divine grace and serendipity, they had already discovered her, starting with a Western chap, Neil Rosner, enduringly known as Nilu, and then later to become an ordained Swami or Sannyasin under the holy woman Amma, the hugging saint. He wrote a book about Amma, but that wouldn't get published later. There was a little book that came over in 1986, and I discovered it in a little bookstore, spiritual bookstore up in Berkeley. I was in San Francisco at the time, finishing grad school, and I read this little book, and I thought, if even half of this is true, this is an amazing being. It's truly one of these divine incarnations in our midst. And I began to tell friends, and some of them helped organize Amma's first tour in the United States. And so I was like one of about, I think it was a dozen people that went to meet her at the airport when she first arrived in 1987.
Uh-huh.
And of course, now she's a world figure. Wherever she goes, there's thousands and thousands of people, and any year now, she's going to, no doubt, I'll make this prediction here on air, she's going to win the Nobel Peace Prize.
Oh, wow.
The Templeton Award.
Wow.
Because already the kind of people who give those kind of awards already know about her.
Wow.
The United Nations has given her various awards and honors, and she's going to be, even bigger than the Dalai Lama and Mother Teresa.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of the number of people coming to see her. Because she's so accessible.
Uh-huh.
She will not leave a place until everyone's had a chance to come up and have that heart-to-heart hug with her and the kind of blessing which, I could try and describe, but really it's a divine mystery what she's doing for people, unlocking these deep old patterns of karma, these deep burdens of pain and trauma and tension and anxiety.
She literally clears the chakras and does all kinds of psychic work, just in her presence, isn't that?
That's correct, Lance.
Yeah. And as I understand it, now, did you also meet Mayor Baba?
He had so-called dropped the body when I was still only a 15-year-old boy in 1969.
Oh.
What's funny, though, a girlfriend of mine from the time who got bored with me, I think, because I was always talking about God after I had this spontaneous awakening when I was 16. About a year and a half later, we'd not seen each other for some months, she called me out of the blue and said she had found God, and it was Meher Baba.
Oh.
Who had just passed away about 2 or 3 years earlier.
Yes.
And then the woman I met when I was 40 and wound up marrying a year later, my wife of the last 11 years, Laura. She is, of course, a Meher Baba devotee.
Oh, wow.
She actually spent about 2 months in India.
Oh, wow.
At the Meher Baba Pilgrim Center in 1986.
Oh, I love Meher Baba.
So it's kind of serendipitous.
It's funny because I have an ex-wife in Santa Barbara named Lorna.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you and I, Lance, have some connections here. Santa Barbara.
Oh, yes, definitely, because, being energy. Born and raised there and so on and so forth. And Santa Barbara is quite a spiritual place, I'm finding out.
The truth is everywhere on the planet.
Well, yes.
A spiritual energy for anyone who simply wants to allow the heart to be opened by the inner, outer divine. There is ultimately no inside or outside.
Yes.
We are being dreamed by the divine, who is the one who alone is the reality of every being.
Tim, how do we connect with that?
Pardon?
How do we connect with that?
Well, it's actually a fun paradox, Lance, because this really gets us down to the gist of what so many of those great spiritual women are teaching that I tried to put a very large amount of teachings in that book, not just biography.
Oh, yeah.
And the India Sages two-volume project I'm working on. In the same way, I'm trying to feature a lot of these teachings because, you know, the old truth is that words are ineffective and are futile pointers to the divine reality. But, you know, in another way, they have this divine power.
Yes.
These true words come true.
Yes.
As a sage, Nisargadatta Maharaj of Bombay, a great sage of the intuitive, non-dual way. I sat with him in Bombay about 8 months before he passed on.
Uh-huh.
He was a powerhouse of spiritual transformation and awakening.
Uh-huh.
And he used to say, you know, these words, you know, on one level, they're ridiculous. You know, it's just rumblings of our vocal cords and flapping of our lips. But he said, true words come true. And what are true words? They're words about our real nature.
Yes.
And this real nature, you asked, you know, how do we connect with this or realize this? We are always already looking from this vast, open, free awareness. My late friend Douglas Harding, who just passed away in January, 1 month shy of his 98th birthday, he of many books, one of his most famous and early books, On Having No Head, he's a great mystic profiled by some modern authors of modern mystics.
Uh-huh.
Douglas and all our great mystics, and it goes right back to Jesus' teachings in the John Gospel and the wonderful discovery of the Gospel of Thomas,
uh-huh.
the Buddha, these great women I wrote about, so many are pointing to an incredible mystery right where we are.
Yes.
Closer than our own mind.
Yes.
As the Quran of Islam says, closer to us than our own jugular vein. We're looking from God, thinking from God, feeling from God, operating from God, flourishing from God. But when we try to make an object out of that for the mind, we won't find God.
Right.
And then we might be seduced into some long search for God. And, of course, there's any number of snake oil salesmen, very
yes.
hucksters and racketeers who've made a real business out of religion.
Yes.
And forms of spirituality, whether old traditional ones or new age ones.
Yeah.
And they try to sucker us into paths that wind up just basically being very complicated when God was always right inside.
Yeah.
Which is why the great mystic Meister Eckhart, a formidable Catholic theologian, philosopher, who was also an amazingly persuasive and electric preacher in his letter training the young nuns and mystics among the women's communities, the Beguine communities in Northern Europe, or mentoring the young friars of the Dominican order and the students of the University of Paris, where he taught after Thomas Aquinas. Meister Eckhart always used to put it so beautifully. He'd say, God is at home, man is abroad. God is at the center, man is out on the periphery.
Hmm.
So what happens is, Lance, we begin to relax and trust that God isn't out there as an object to be found at the level of the mind
mm-hmm.
or to be gained through some kind of complicated religious or spiritual or other kind of path that some huckster is trying to seduce us into going through.
Uh-huh.
And we often are told we have to pay a lot of money and go through painful initiations or whatever.
Right.
The real mystical teaching is that God is always our very inside and the inside of everyone we meet. God is this purely subjectively obvious, not objectively obvious, because God is not an object,
mm-hmm.
but subjectively obvious as this pure, free, clear, open, vast awareness. It's what we're basically deploying to listen to these words or feel bodily sensations or to host thoughts or emotions. It's the mysterious principle of what our most ancient wisdom text on the planet, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, almost 3,000 years old,
uh-huh.
Calls the unseen seer of seeing, the unthought thinker of thinking. You could also say maybe the unfelt feeler of feeling. So the bottom line point here is that we look from and operate from a tremendous mystery that also miraculously turns out to be the very source of the universe.
Huh.
Call it God or the goddess, the self, pure awareness, the Tao or Buddha nature. And so it's a kind of self-inquiry, as Socrates saw on the portal over the gateway to the oracle at Delphi.
Uh-huh.
You know, these women psychics who would basically serve as prophetesses or trance channels and bring through messages from the one divine spirit. Socrates saw written on the portal over the gateway into the oracle area this Greek inscription that basically translates, "Man, know thyself." We have an early tradition among the Christian mystics, the desert fathers and mothers. St. Anthony the Great, the founder of that movement, said, you know, if a man or a woman knows himself, he will know God. Prophet Muhammad later gave the same kind of hadith or saying to his community. And it's, of course, the great message of our Eastern wisdom traditions.
But, you know, it seems like I love what you're saying, and it seems like we've either turned away from God towards materialism, and we've also disconnected from nature. Are you seeing that too? I mean, I see corruption and greed, and I hate to use the word evil, but, you know, it's the only word that comes to mind.
The way I see it is, you know, when someone is not intuitively coming from this incredibly powerful, solid, you know, God is the only solid reality. Everything else in the world
is
our
not
experience
real.
Is passing dream. It's flux.
Yeah.
Whether our body, which appears so solid, it's actually just made of cells, made of molecules, made of atoms, made of subatomic mystery. You know, up on my website, I have a lot of stuff about the new physics, and I have a book manuscript about that. You had our dear friend Swami Abhayananda on your program recently, and he's written a beautiful book, Mysticism and Science.
Yes.
And he's gone into this, and the good Swamiji knows that I actually have a manuscript I've just got sitting on my shelf, that is on my word processor, that I'm going to turn to about a year and a half or two when I'm finished the India Sages projects and have some time. But, you know, everything we know about modern physics relates to us, reveals to us that there is incredible mystery right down at the core of what used to be thought to be solid atoms.
Yeah.
So the body is in flux. It's impermanent. It's a passing show. What about the mind and the emotions? Well, any kind of introspective self-inquiry, as suggested by William James, the founder of Western psychology, that is in America, you know, kind of a more intimate approach to psychology than the Freudian and behaviorist approach that started over in Europe. James suggested this introspection, and what one finds, that's the same with old Buddhist mindfulness 2,500 years ago, you find out that the emotions aren't solid, the mind is not solid, the self-concept is not solid, the very sense of self is not solid because it's literally disappearing every night in deep, dreamless sleep.
Uh-huh.
And the body, mind, ego sense just falls off completely. So, nothing is solid about us, our experience, our world, even the most apparently solid cement building or monolith, like a big boulder or something, turns out not to be solid at all. It's 99.999999% empty space.
That's right. That's
as
right.
The physicists are saying. So, that being the case, is there anything solid? Well, it turns out this deep spiritual awareness principle in you, that is solid. And when I say that, I mean this. We have to be clear with our language that we don't put God or the self, with a capital S, out there.
Right.
That God self is right here, closer to us than our own mind. It's absolutely, immediately, that is without mediary, true of us, right here, right now. Well, what happens, to go back to your concern about the evil and, you know, the disregard for nature and one another.
Yeah.
When people don't clearly, intuitively come from their deep, solid reality as God, pure light, pure love, pure truth, what happens is they feel very vulnerable.
Uh-huh.
They'll feel insecure. They'll feel restless and needy. And that's when the wonderful divine Leela, the play, in the form of the apparent madness and mischief and mayhem and murder ensues. And people start mistreating each other. They get into needy conflicts over land or who gets to be right in terms of, say, political opinions. They covet thy neighbor's goods and wife, as Jesus and the Torah warned against. And all sorts of, quote, evil will ensue.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's an old idea, certainly in our Eastern spiritual traditions, and it's right there in our dawn of our Western spiritual traditions, and I'm thinking specifically of the early Christian community. Some of the greatest, most brilliant theologians of all time, people like Clement and Origen of Alexandria, Gregory of Nyssa, later the greatest Christian mind in the medieval era, John Scotus Origena, whom I have a big paper on at my website, they all taught a doctrine that's been lost to the West called apokatastasis. It's a Greek word meaning universal restoration or universal salvation.
Uh-huh.
It's the basic idea that even the evildoers, even Satan, Lucifer, the light bearer, the first and fallen angel from the old Western myth, will ultimately be dissolved back into God's love, because God's love is all-powerful.
Huh.
No one can exile themselves into evil or darkness or selfishness forever, because God's reality is their true reality. As St. Thomas Aquinas, the great Orthodox theologian of Christianity, said, you know, we only have a sense of being insofar as it derives from God's being. To put it another way, God's self, the God self, what they call the Atma in the ancient Hindu Vedanta tradition, this God self is the self of all selves, the being behind all beings.
Huh.
And so, even the evildoers, we really have to look with great compassion and care, because we can't throw them out of our heart. They
right.
too are a disguise of God, and somehow, some way, the divine self, all-pervasive, beyond all beings but within all beings, as their very heart, their very inside, will melt these personalities back into the transpersonal divine.
Mm.
And yes, it is true. We have a period where there is a lot of greed. We have technology and weaponry that can, in many ways, exacerbate these old human tendencies that have been with us for thousands and thousands of years. And so it looks in some ways like things are getting worse with developments like global warming and, you know, the ability through high-tech weaponry to take out more people and massacre or poison people. It looks pretty gnarly.
Yeah.
But when we really get clear about who we are, what the nature of the world really is, and who our neighbor is, truly, love thy neighbor as thyself, as the Torah and then later Jesus both say, then a lot of our sense of, oh my God, what's happening here, to all those evildoers, we relax into the heart and realize everyone is a child or manifestation of this one God self. And that's why, like in the lingo of the old Black Baptist spirituals, we can just sing about all God's chillin'.
When you were traveling in India, did you what were some of your the miraculous experiences that you had there, or do you have any favorite experiences of that you could tell us about?
Oh, that's a fun question, Lance. It would take days and weeks to talk about it. And, you know, the greatest miracle of all, which is ongoing for everyone at any time, is just the fact that the one can appear as many, that the divine God self can manifest with all this incredible diversity. So all the molecules and atoms, but on the more interesting level for us humans, fellow humans, animals, shrubs, trees, sky, clouds, mountains, streams, even man-made objects. It's all just one incredibly blessed miracle that any of this is happening at all.
Mm-hmm.
And in a place like India, there is a vibration there. I mean, when I came back from my very first trip to India, about a four-month trip in 1980-81,
uh-huh.
I'd first gone to Burma with some dear friends including a Burmese nun who taught up at my alma mater, the graduate school in San Francisco, the California Institute of Integral Studies.
Oh, yeah.
I got my MA and PhD. I went with Rina Sirkar, a beautiful Buddhist 10-precept nun and healer, meditation teacher and instructor in Buddhism there at the Institute. She was going to be going to Burma, now known as Myanmar, with about 10 of her students. And because her brother and sisters had moved to Pondicherry, India, she was then going to be going from Burma to India. Now, I had been wanting to go to India, and I thought, oh, this is the perfect chance to not only go to India, because Rina and her friends would kind of drop off at Pondicherry, a town on the southeast coast, and I was planning on traveling all over India. But I realized I would have the chance to go up into the jungles of northern Burma and ordain temporarily, as most Southeast Asian males do at some point in their life. I would be able to ordain under this incredible spiritual master named Tongpu Zedaw, who lived and taught, meditated there up in northern Burma.
Uh-huh.
So I went there first, got my head shaved, became a monk for a time, and then went to the formal deordination process, just as I and my buddies had gone through the ordination process. And I came down to Pondicherry with Rina and her friends and met her dear brother and sisters. And then I headed off on my own on a very serendipitous trip. There was one connection after another. It was like one, you know, little mini miracle after another.
Huh.
But, you know, when I came back, someone asked me, well, what's it like in India? And I said, well, it's like heaven. It's like hell. It's like everything in between and that which is beyond.
Huh.
And I also had this very clear sense that, you know, God is everywhere.
Uh-huh.
You can discover God as much, you know, pumping gas at the gas station or driving in your car, sitting at your grandmother's house or grandchild's little play area, as sitting in India in an ashram or a temple or a monastery.
Right.
But the fact is, there are certain holy or sacred places where the truth that God is omnipresent somehow seems more real and vivid.
Yeah.
And that's why we do have holy places and consecrated grounds. And of course, in the person of some of these God-realized beings, call them divine incarnations or people who have, quote, ascended to God and become great sages or saints, there's a very palpable, vivid sense God alone is real.
Uh-huh.
God is the one playing all these parts. God is the true self playing all these different soul roles, so to say. And, you know, again, that can happen anywhere. It can happen while you're in the kitchen washing your vegetables and or playing with the cat or dog or just walking down the street and looking at so-called strangers.
True.
That no one's strange at all.
True.
We are all the dear, beloved one. And so this creates tremendous sense of intimacy and love and bliss and real delight.
Do you feel that this is a particular, let me see if I can say this, do you feel that this is like an end time or a quickening that we're headed towards some kind of a resolution of the end of a period of some sort? I know there's Mayan prophecies that tell us, and several people indicate that 2012 might be a significant date. What's your feeling about that?
Well, as I often share with students in different classes and satsang groups I have going here in Santa Barbara, or when I'm invited to speak in different places, you know, the truth is we die every second.
True.
There's an Armageddon every moment.
Right.
There's also creation every moment, as Meister Eckhart, again, 700 years ago up in Germany, would tell his congregations and students and novices, you know, that thing we read about in Genesis of God creating the world, that's happening now. God's eternal now.
Yeah.
And as the Buddha showed us 2,500 years ago, the wondrous method of mindfulness meditation, where you can see it for yourself in direct experience, not as a concept or hearsay. Everything about us in the world is vanishing moment by moment.
True.
And so at the beginning of each moment, we are this unformed, undefined, vast, open, free, divine awareness. And there's this fun, divine mischief. Again, the wonderful word that the Indians use, the lila, the play of the divine. And through the power of the mind and a body sense and energy fields and, you know, molecular bonding and electron shells and the whole play of nature that's so fascinating when you get into this with modern science. Through all of these various dynamic aspects, we have conjured up for us a sense of a solid world.
Yeah.
And then, having been suckered by that, I mean, if we're not spiritually clear about what's arising and vanishing moment by moment, we take the world as real, we take ourself, the ego sense, to be real.
Yeah.
Me, the mind-body personality, and we reify it or thingify it. And then we reify or thingify other body-mind beings. And so our world is contaminated by this sense of all these separate things.
Yes.
We're all bumping off each other as solid entities. But the fact is, it's not solid. It's a dream unfolding, and it's sourced in and sustained by and merges in and is made of this one divine awareness. So we are concerned, naturally, about end times. It's human nature. Part of the play of being a human being is in this identification with a body-mind. We think there's a past and a future. The human mind is fascinated by and disturbed by the unknown.
Yeah.
So much of our behavior is not instinctually wired. It has to develop out of forms of knowing orchestrated by the mind, or so we think.
Right.
And limited to that finite sense of being a body-mind, what happens is we are disturbed about what is the future going to bring. And so we not only try to prepare ourselves and armor ourselves and grab as much in the way of goods and possessions, food and land, and big, nowadays it's about having a big portfolio, a lot of assets in your name, to survive any coming financial economic crunch. But no matter how much we try to possess and armor ourselves with, we still want to know about the future. So we hire all sorts of people working in whether astrology or palmistry or being able to discern the signs of the era. And we have certain scriptures that people love to just wrap their brains around, figure out what they mean, whether it's the book of Revelation or certain elements in the Quran or Mayan calendar data as we try to decipher it. And so we become fascinated by the end times. But, you know, as I often tell students, there's this wonderful passage in the Gospel of Thomas. You know, that book was dormant for Christianity for about 1,600 years until it was very serendipitously discovered in 1945 as part of the Nag Hammadi collection. And in one of the 114 sayings in that sayings gospel, the Gospel of Thomas, the disciples come to Jesus and they ask him how to recognize the end times. How will we know what our end will be?
Uh-huh.
And Jesus says, have you discovered the beginning? Then you can now ask about the end. You know, if you discover the beginning, there the end is. Blessed is he who stands as he was before the beginning, before he came into being. It's an amazing passage, and it speaks to that intuitive mysticism, sagely knowing by being. It's like the Zen koans, you know, where were you a million years ago, or what was your original no face before your face? What were you before your parents were born?
Yeah.
It's a koan or a riddle to point you back to the power of intuition from what you're already looking from. And so Jesus' teaching in other parts of the Gospel of Thomas and the four canonical Gospels as well, is that the kingdom of God is already here. The kingdom is within. It's also spread out in our midst. It's a teaching that we don't really need to worry about the future if we are coming clearly from the present in love and compassion, honesty, humility, great openness for this peace and bliss of God. Then we don't have to worry.
Can you explain a little bit about non-dual spirituality? Your website has a lot of information about that, and I want to make sure that you also mention how people can find your website, because it's got a wealth of wonderful spiritual writings on it that people can delve into.
Yes, a dear friend of mine, colleague, fellow teacher said, basically, it's going to take him years to fathom everything that's at that site. It's basically 30 years of writing of papers and research on sacred traditions and meetings with sages all over the world. It's www.enlightened-spirituality.org. So
good.
It's enlightenedspirituality.org, and just simply put a hyphen between enlightened and spirituality.
Good.
And there's all these different domains. There's a section on healthy spirituality and basically looking at what counts for real, authentic spiritual or God realization.
Yeah.
Warning signs on dysfunctional cults that are out there. It's got a whole section on science and spirituality. The biggest is the one on religion and spirituality, where I have overview papers of our different religions, and also a lot of material on, in terms of life and teachings of great sages and saints from different traditions. There's a whole section, for instance, on the teachings of Jesus and analysis of the different sources we have for those teachings. And then there is, among other things, there's a huge spiritual humor section. It's funny.
Oh, yes.
Traffic statistics indicate that's the site most people go to first.
You have
even
something
a Zen
there.
Humor page there that might really enlighten you. But there is a big section on non-dual spirituality, and that's really kind of what's in vogue in spirituality today. It's basically defined as this realization that ultimately there is not a multiplicity or a duality. So, for instance, many Christians of certain denominations tend to be a bit obsessed about not just Jesus, but also Satan. The obsession with Jesus would be a great thing if we actually lived according to his social gospel and his deep mystical teachings and just lived that oneness with the Father that he prayed that all the disciples also enjoy. You know, he prayed at the Last Supper discourse relayed in the John Gospel, you know, may the disciples be one with the Father as I am one with the Father. But, you know, there's an obsession with Satan we find in a lot of these kind of more ultra-conservative evangelical and ultra-Catholic circles. And, you know, this winds up being very dualistic and can breed a temperament of paranoia, the authoritarian temperament, which is that aspect. Put it this way, I think there's about 10 to 15% of humanity that suffers from this authoritarian complex. And it appears in the corporate world, in the political world, in the sports world. And also appears, unfortunately, in the religious world. You know, when people like Bill Maher or you know, others put down religion and just kind of try to make the whole thing be painted with a single brush as bad and evil and the source of a lot of problems, they really misspeak, because the problems in religion, as in politics or in corporate life or family life or whatever, is this authoritarian temperament that cannot see anything in any subtle or nuanced way. It's very black and white thinking. It's a lot of control issues, a lot of insider-outsider exclusivism and so forth. Well, that authoritarian temperament relishes duality. Non-dual spirituality comes from a much deeper place in us, a really deep, intuitive place of light and love and freedom and great delight and bliss. And it knows that there's one reality here, manifesting as all forms and experiences and phenomena. And so when we really are clear about this intuitively, and who is clear about it? It's the divine self within us that becomes clear. God knows God through a human being by virtue of this divine power of knowing. And we call that in the West gnosis, G-N-O-S-I-S. And that word, that Greek word, actually derives from much older Sanskrit words from the Upanishads and the Buddha's teachings. Words like jnana and prajna and vijnana. that kind of divine knowing in us knows that there's only one reality. And so that means that ultimately there's no difference on the deepest level between the soul and God. And that's why we have so much of that mystical devotional poetry where it basically essentially boils down to, you know, the play of devotion between the soul and God is none other than God loving God through the form, the mind, the heart of the devotee. And we get these beautiful lines about the lover becomes one with the beloved, and finally it is realized there was always only the beloved.
Yeah.
It also turns out with non-dual spirituality, there's ultimately no difference between one soul and another soul, which is again why the ancient Hebrew Bible, quoted by Jesus as the second of his great commandments, teaches love thy neighbor as thyself.
Yes.
Your neighbor's reality is not merely a body-mind, a separate personality. They're wearing that as a disguise of God, but their essential reality. And when you really look deeply into someone's eyes or feel deeply into their heart, you really get this, that their reality is the same as your reality.
Mm-hmm.
We have these different personalities, and vive la différence, as the French say. It's again a miracle that God can come up with all this diversity. But deep down, there's only God here. And the same non-duality then also would hold not just between one human and another, but between humans and non-humans. And that's why many folks, most famously including the philosopher Peter Singer and Tom Regan, they're arguing that we have to start advocating the rights of higher organisms, that is, the animals that have more developed nervous systems. We have to establish the position that these are persons and they have certain rights. And so, in other words, we can't just destroy their habitat or, you know, poison them or just knock out entire species.
Like the bees?
Oh, and the polar bears. And, you know, all you have to do is talk to the biologists and zoologists and others, and they're just terrified. The amount of species that are disappearing is just unbelievable.
Well, I'll be concerned if the dolphins leave, because I think they're a little bit more intelligent than we are in some ways.
My dear cousin, Evie Williams, she might even be listening in to this tonight with her family. She, as a young girl, growing up in South Miami, where my Uncle Marvin and Aunt Margaret lived, she went and did work with John Lilly on the dolphins. I was reading John Lilly's books about dolphins and other scientists' works on dolphins and whales, and the finding was that they have these huge brains.
Yeah.
And, you know, in college, I was an undergrad at the University of California up at Santa Cruz.
Oh.
I double majored in psychology and religious studies. In the psychology department, we had some folks that were very respected in their field. And, you know, in the old textbooks, we'd see these pictures of different animal brains leading up to the human brain. And it always was presented in such a way as to make the human brain look like the crown of creation.
You're right. Right,
compared to a cat brain or a pig brain or lower down a bird brain or something. But then it turns out if you were to put in pictures of whale and dolphin brains, their brains make our brains look simplistic the way they our brains make a cat brain look simplistic by comparison.
Wow. Well, that's not surprising.
Again, my sense is that the one divine God self, this amazing love being, the very principle of truth, beauty, and goodness, the one whom we all praise in our different languages and different faiths, has just pulled off the biggest, most whopping, colossal miracle of all in dreaming up all this diversity.
Yes.
Nearly 14 billion-year-old physical cosmos with all of these incredible beings on this planet and probably other planets, and not to mention the subtle realms, psychic realms of where our departed loved ones who've so-called died. They don't die. They just drop the body and they're wearing a different kind of energetic form.
Yes.
And so also as maybe angel kind of beings and spirit guides. It's an amazing cosmos we get to be associated with.
You know, I think one of the things that's frustrating for me as I go along is to, you know, expand my awareness to all of these different aspects of what's possible and to be limited by the consciousness and the reality that I find myself in.
Well, that's interesting. You know, what you asked earlier about a method, say, a way of connecting to this truth.
Hmm.
Among the various angles onto this, all-pervasive, everywhere and nowhere divine truth, is the realization that we are never, in fact, trapped inside a body-mind.
Mm.
We commonly use this term incarnation, or we'll speak of reincarnation.
Mm.
But as I never tire of sharing with friends and students, that's kind of a misnomer because it suggests that we are literally incarnate in the meat. And
right.
You know, this is the mainstream teaching in most of academia and the more reductionist, materialistic circles of scientism, which is that materialistic religion of science. It's not pure science. It's
right.
A particular point of view that really only about 30% of the scientific academy holds. Most of the rest actually believe in God. Surveys for Nature and Science magazine have shown that a tremendous number of physicists and biologists believe there is some kind of God, either the personal Lord of the Judeo-Christian biblical tradition, or as Einstein and Fred Hoyle and many others intuited, a more kind of transpersonal God,
yeah.
Not impersonal, but not merely personal.
Uh-huh.
So that suggests we have to open up our model theologically of God. Pantheism doesn't work, the idea that God is nothing more than the sum of the parts
right,
of creation.
Right.
But mere theism doesn't work either, just putting God up there in the sky, separate from Earth and
right.
The cosmos and humanity and animals. So what we need is what has been called panentheism. Not pantheism, but not mere theism, but panentheism, which basically means all in God and God in all.
Oh, I like
that. It suggests that God is beyond all and yet within all. And that's
yeah.
true of our real nature as awareness. We're not really trapped inside of a body or a mental point of view. We pervade it, but we literally transcend it. That's why it's so beautiful with this non-dual spirituality. There's no danger of alienation or otherworldliness because you feel absolutely present and pervading everything that happens, everyone, starting with your own body, mind, and emotions. So you're not estranged from or fragmented off from what's presently going on with your body, mind, emotional set. And in the same way, you feel absolutely intimate with everyone you meet and everything you encounter.
Yes, and that does tend to open up synchronicities and emotional connections when we see others as ourselves.
Very deeply. I could talk on and on about that. I'm aware we probably have limited time here, and you might still maybe have some burning questions you might have.
Well, I just want to say something about your book, that it's just, you know, it's a riveting book. You know, I had no idea that the divine feminine had embodied in such phenomenal manners. And what I really like about your writing style is that you don't lead the reader into conclusions. You leave it very loose and open. You're very fluid about letting the mystical experiences speak for themselves.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderfully clear and easy way to read. And then at the end of each of these women's stories, which are fascinating, I mean, I could not put the book down.
Yeah.
You have some of their writings when they have writings. Some of them, not all of them, wrote or spoke, and you know, and so on and so forth. But they're all fascinating. I tended to be interested most in the ones towards the end of the Eastern,
right?
You know, and of course Amma, I just fell in love with her. She's just
You know, there's a number of Ammas in India. It's kind of a generic
title in German.
But she was originally basically known as Amati, Little Amma, because her public ministry started when she was so young. She has a long formal name, Mata Amrita Nandamayi. But our listeners can simply find out much more about her and the incredible worldwide service work she is doing and has inspired so many thousands of people to adopt. And that's a simple website, AMMA.org.
Oh, good.
AMMA.org. And they'll find all sorts of inspiring stuff there. And again, AMMA visits the West every year in Europe and travels to different parts of India and sometimes parts of Asia. We hear she's about to make her first visit any year now down in Latin America.
Wow.
My sense is through that region that has such a deep old Catholic love for Mother Mary, they will see her as some kind of divine feminine.
Oh, yes.
And they'll just swallow her up in love, and it'll be mutual.
Oh, yes.
So anyone who wants to see AMMA might want to do it this year, because, again, any year now, I think she's going to win the Nobel Peace Prize or something,
yeah.
And it'll be more difficult, perhaps, to see her. But she has vowed that she's always going to remain as accessible to as many people as possible.
And she also claims that she's going to live a long life, so... And I guess on that level, you actually know those things, or you choose the time that you're going to depart.
Yeah, with AMMA, I mean, I can speculate, and it'd be fairly informed speculation, because I've been studying great sages and saints and divine incarnations.
Uh-huh.
I was very young, East and West, male and female.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, she's just a beautiful mystery, and sometimes I just want to not try and think about her. I've certainly done enough of that. Just to feel that divine love that is formless and beyond and in everyone, and yet somehow has taken the form of this amazing woman who's showing us what it is to be the mother to the world. And she says if we all, each in our own way, adopted to some extent or other this mood or attitude of the universal mother, then we would come from love and caring and strength and fearlessness and desirelessness, and our lives would be just such a beautiful, fragrant flower of blessing to everyone, and it would be like contagion.
Yes.
We'd all fall in love with each other and help move forward with our political solutions in a progressive way to solve our pressing problems. And
do you think that there are, I mean, other than the Dalai Lama, are there other divine incarnations that you're aware of at this time?
Well, you know, to call them divine incarnations, I use that phrase rather specifically to mean someone whom it appears associated with his body-mind. Again, I don't like to use even the word incarnation because it suggests we're literally inside the meat.
Right,
pervade the bodies, but we're certainly not limited to them. Non-local awareness or pure open consciousness, call it what you will.
Okay.
And then there are beings who realize God, you know, maybe after years or at least months of some struggle or searching. And so I'll kind of distinguish between these much more rarely occurring divine appearances or avatar types.
Right.
Like a Jesus or the Buddha, Shankara, AMMA. Folks like Ramana Maharshi, Ramakrishna. There's a number of beings, some of these child prodigies you see in the different sacred traditions that seem to be like divine manifestations within the dream to wake us up.
Yes.
And then there's others of us who are just aspiring for more complete and full expression of the divine. You know, there's figures out there like Thay Chek Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese meditation master and peacemaker. If I started talking now, Lance, I could probably talk for about another 20 minutes.
Okay. Well,
again,
we'll have to do another show together.
You can find a fair number of names up at the website. Teachings and biographies of some of these great spiritual leaders at the enlightenedspirituality.org website. And remember, there's a hyphen there between enlightened and spirituality.
Yes.
Why don't you just Google my name, Timothy Conway, and spirituality, and they'll probably get it pretty quick on a Google return search.
Well, you know, this hour has just flown by on angel wings.
Same here, Lance. Your questions are profound and come from the heart, and it's the kind of forum that just makes my heart sing.
Well,
and
if you're
open to it and have run out of guests, there's so many wonderful people out there sharing and teaching that I'm happy to answer more questions for your listeners at some other time, if you want.
Well, I'd love to have you back again because, I mean, we've just kind of barely dipped our fingers into the juice of the you know, and I've learned so much from talking to you. And like I said, your book is so inspiring. Oh, and the other thing I liked about it is that you included pictures of these women, and just the whole feeling of it. I mean, rarely do I get moved by books in a spiritual way. And I think you spoke about that earlier, about how books, you know, are just words and so on. But you have captured the essence of the spirit of these beings. And I'm telling you, I could feel some strange things.
Well, you're not alone, Lance. People have been writing in or emailing in over the years. That book is now a decade old.
Oh, really?
And I hear amazing testimonials from people. You see, I didn't really capture anything, and I didn't do anything. The power of God through those great women,
yeah,
their exemplary lives, and that force field of love around them that's boundless, it just kind of grabbed me one day years ago and made me sit down at the word processor and tell their story and share their teaching. So, frankly, I had very little to do with it. There was all sorts of miraculous things that were involved in how that book all came into being.
Well, and
what it does stun me is how many people are touched by one or more of these women. These women, in other words, haven't died, and of course, Alma's still with us.
Still with us, yes.
They will find a way to open you up.
Yes.
It's the power of God within us that's using the book or these women or any other kind of encounters and experiences in your life to wake people up.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Timothy, for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Lance. I look forward to more sharings and more interaction.
Me too.
Love to you and all listening and all beings.
All right.
Alone.
Many blessings.
Thank you, Lance.
All right. Good night, everybody.